Hello, this is Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. Welcome to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams. Today's episode is about space exploration, and I'd originally slated for this program to play you bits and pieces from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, maybe some Star Wars and Space 1999, various other odd sort of frivolous things, but I've started listening more and more to the recordings of the actual American space missions, the Mercury missions, which were the original manned astronaut ones, and then the Gemini missions, and then obviously the Apollo missions. And to tell you the truth, there's so much depth and richness in the recordings and some of the documentary recordings as well, especially some of the sound design in them, that actually I'm not going to play any of the frivolous stuff. I'm just going to play material which is really just related to the serious thing. So, sorry, it might not be much fun in that kind of way, but hopefully you'll get a lot out of this program. If you get even a tenth as much as I have through listening to all the different records, then yeah, I think you'll be doing well. So I'm going to kick off with a record from Time Life, which is called To the Moon, and you're going to hear all kinds of voices in this. I'll keep punctuating it and maybe mix some other things in, but you'll get some narration as well. Okay, here we go.
Today I will speak about the proposal for an electric spaceship that doesn't use
That is the actual voice of the third great space pioneer, Professor Hermann Oberth, speaking before a group of distinguished scientists and engineers. In a 1923 pamphlet, The Rocket into Interplanetary Space, Oberth makes some wild predictions. That someday, it will be possible to orbit a large manned rocket around the Earth. That passengers will leave it in a smaller landing rocket, visit another planet, and go home the same way. A Russian, an American, a German, all working with pencil and paper to solve the problems of flight to the moon. 1926, Auburn, Massachusetts. The world pays little or no attention to Robert Goddard's history-making launch of the first liquid fuel rocket. As his widow recalls,
it was March 16th. A cold day, but fortunately no wind. My husband had an igniter at the head of the rocket, and Mr. Sachs had a blowtorch on a stick and applied the blowtorch to start the rocket. The rocket itself was lightweight aluminum, bit almost like a toy, and even now people marvel at the quality of the parts in it. This first flight took a little long to get started, but when the jet came, it was brilliantly white and beautiful and smokeless. And it made exactly the same kind of noise that you hear now on a small scale. It went up, I think, probably 50 or 60 feet, and then angled off and landed in a cabbage patch with very old cabbages in it in March.
Mrs. Goddard later wrote that the rocket actually reached an altitude of 41 feet, was in the air for 2.5 seconds, averaging 60 miles per hour, and landed 184 feet from the launch frame. As always, she served as her husband's official photographer.
So, switching from rockets landing in cabbage patches to something slightly more serious, sinister, if you like, we move back over to Europe and hear from Dr. Dornberger, or Major General Dornberger, as he was, and his a recording of him talking about the V2 project in Peenemünde, and that kind of crops up a little bit with the Russians as well. And of course, there was a great race to get the technology and get the scientists, get the workers, and whoever got which bits. That was a matter of a lot of debate and secrecy for a long time. Anyway, Dr. Dornberger.
And we, against the wish of Hitler, we proceeded with our work in Peenemünde for years. And when it was finally finished, and we had the first successful launchings, Professor Speer, the ammunition minister, went to Hitler's headquarters and told him that this thing seemed to be ready now. and he wanted more money and top priority. And Hitler told him, no, yesterday you sent me some schedule, what you want to talk about, and I dreamed about last night, and I dreamed that this weapon would never reach England. And therefore it's no use to give any money. I can trust my thinking.
Late in the day, Hitler, realizing his mistake, makes one of the few apologies of his life to General Dornberger. And in July 1943, orders crash production of that supersonic rocket missile, the A-4. It's the second of a series of airborne weapons that propaganda minister Goebbels calls Vergeltungswaffen, or revenge weapons, to bombard London in reprisal for Allied air raids on Germany. The world comes to know it as the V-2.
Rather strange, triumphal music there at the end. Kind of bigs up the V2 quite a lot. Actually, wasn't very triumphant for people who were underneath it when it was being dropped on London. Anyway, we're moving on to a Russian view of the same operation. I think this is one of the scientists on the Russian project. I think he later defected to Britain.
But when the units of the 19th Army reached Peenemünde, the technological disappointment was greater than the pride of seeing the red flag flying over the ruins, or had been dismantled, loaded on special vehicles and trains, and taken away to America. Projects, research materials, test equipment, rockets, unfinished products, the most valuable means of production, always all scientists and engineers, and even the furniture, had managed to escape from Peenemünde. Here we are, the chief engineer of the Soviet Air Forces said, the flag of our victory flies over Berlin. But the most deadly weapons of the fallen enemy have walked over to the Americans.
Yeah, some quite subtle editing going on there, or not quite so subtle. One of the things that you draw from this is these background sounds. Now, this is a documentary record or a box set of records, so there's a certain amount of sound design going on. You'd like to think there's a lot of original sound that's in there, but some of the machine sounds that are behind the interviewers I'm quite fascinated with, and some of the reverberation on some of the voices, on Dornberger's voice, for example, is quite astonishing. We'll go here another little bit from Takhari, and then we'll go into something else.
I remember saying to Dr. Bard, we won the war and lost the V2, but we are going to win the jet rocket race quite independently of you, the Germans. But how, he asked. I will tell you how, was my reply. We will marry our own theories and projects with your production experience, and that will be good enough.
Well, skipping on a little bit from all the hows and whys and wherefores, we come to the first spaceship. The first thing launched into space, not including the X-15 project, which you can read all about in The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe. But whether these are original recordings or not, it's hard to tell, actually, because there's so much sort of Doppler or speed changing. But, hopefully they are. Anyway, have a listen.
Meanwhile. October 4th, 1957. A faint, baby-like bleat, transmitted by radio from 200 miles out in space, signals to the world the birth of a new age.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created.
Unhampered by the inhibitions which have kept us from a military launch vehicle, the Russians have launched Sputnik, atop their ICBM.
November 3rd, 1957. 30 days after Sputnik 1, Russia throws a second traveling companion into space. This time it carries a half-ton payload into orbit at 18,000 miles an hour. There's also a passenger aboard, a dog, Laika, the first living creature to orbit the Earth. All over the world, people step outside their houses and their huts to glimpse the Russian flash in the sky.
And we can't even send up a basketball.
How could it happen? We're supposed to be the richest nation in the world, right?
Right.
The smartest?
Right.
The most powerful?
Yeah, right again.
So how come the Russians made monkeys out of us?
So in the context of this particular record, it's just setting up the story, I guess. But this next bit is, again, about some American failures building up to the great successes. But check out the explosion sound in this. This is astonishing recording.
Minus 25 seconds. 25.
December 6th, 1957. A modest test of the three-stage rocket of Project Vanguard has long been planned for this date. A White House spokesman announces incorrectly that we are planning to orbit our instrument package. The world press sees this as America's answer to Sputnik. Reporters and TV crews swarm to the area to give the event full coverage. Our supposed answer to Sputnik is an inglorious flop. The first stage explodes, and the rest collapses in the wet sand in full TV view. It has become unmistakable, finally, that Russia, as she herself has long claimed, has the jump on us in the space race. But, in fact, we've not been exactly left standing at the starting line. For more than a year, Wernher von Braun and his rocket crew, working now under U.S. Army General Medaris, as they once worked under Wehrmacht General Dornberger, have had their Jupiter C ready to go. That same military rocket we held back for fear of offending the scientific world.
20.
January 31st, 1958. Washington finally permits the Army agency to make available the Jupiter C. 84 days after the launch of Sputnik 2, we reply to Moscow. Atop this rocket, we fire into orbit Explorer 1, a 31-pound package of instruments developed by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the first U.S. Earth satellite. A decade later, it is still in orbit. As a consolation for its smallness compared to Sputnik, Explorer 1 sends back to Earth precious scientific discoveries about the nature of space. In the judgment of Dr. von Braun,
the launch of Explorer 1, our answer to Sputnik, was a far cry from the much larger Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2. We succeeded nevertheless, even with our very first Explorer 1 flight, to make a major discovery. This discovery was a belt of trapped electromagnetic radiation surrounding the Earth. Jim Van Allen had speculated that such a belt might exist, but it was actually through the flight of Explorer 1 that the existence of the belt was verified, and it is only very proper that this belt now bears Jim Van Allen's name.
Now the race is on in earnest. The race to the moon. It's a contest that has been in the making since the turn of the century, but with scratch teams only, and few spectators. Now, each side has thrown in the cream of its talent. Now the stadium is packed. All the world is watching. The stakes are enormous. Statesmen will pretend from time to time that only a friendly scientific competition is involved. Not necessarily. For at stake now are such matters as political power, military might, and world prestige. Russia, a dictatorship, can dispense with much of the discussion and delay that are the price of democracy. America, until now, has been bogged down by committee. Now, finally, it frees itself and its powers for a vast new surge into space. And all the world is watching.
So, bombastic music aside, that's really the technological side. We're going to talk about, somebody's going to talk about some other machines later on, specifically the Saturn V rocket and the lunar module. But we're going to just go back. It makes me think of Gary McKinnon, this next little section, set in the Pentagon.
A high-level chimpanzee that was going along as a biological experiment. Or would he really have important things to do? It had even been suggested that we might seal him all up without any opening door at all, and he would use a can opener to get out. Well, during that period, things evolved somewhat away from the guinea pig, more towards the concept that the man would be a very important backup to the whole flight procedure, that much of the success of the flight would depend on the man backing up the automatic systems in the Mercury capsule. As this concept became...
To recruit candidates, a civil service job description is prepared. In guarded language, it calls for the services of 40 scientific specialists. But the White House suddenly junks the civil service flyer before it goes out. It would be an embarrassing public admission that we were so far behind the Russians as to have not yet started training even one astronaut. Instead, the White House decides on another likely source of future astronauts, military test pilots, who have at least 1,500 hours of flight time. Also, to fit the tight squeeze of the capsule, they must be under 6 feet in height, and under 40 years of age, so as to ensure enough continuing stamina in the years ahead. Personnel records of Air Force, Navy, and Marine test pilots are run through card selectors. All this while, Von Braun and his army team have been told to push ahead their work on the most powerful booster conceivable. Ultimately, it will be known to the world as the Saturn V. Although nobody is yet talking officially about a flight to the moon, it's the Saturn V that will send us there. The card selectors have coughed up the names of 508 test pilots who meet the first requirement. The 508 are at work at air bases, out at sea with a fleet, or at desk jobs. Unknown to them, a second line evaluation is being made the world over through talks with their commanding officers. The Pentagon, working in a hush-hush atmosphere of top secrecy and maximum security, sifts the number of prospects down to 110, who will be called to Washington in three separate batches for personal interviews and testing. And for all the Pentagon's extreme precautions, well, as Dr. Vos tells the story...
I'd had to make the arrangement to get our Navy records, and we got both the personnel records and the medical records on these individuals, and Bill Augerson and Stan White were looking at the medical records while the rest of us were looking at flight records and so on. And so there was a large cart which had all the records on them from the Navy, and we had that in this room, which was all locked up in the Pentagon. But we went out to lunch one day, and I came back to find all of the records on this cart and the cart missing. And I was appalled, of course, because to lose these records is to lose the people. Those were the prime record that exists in personnel, and if those records are gone, these people just vanish from the earth. And so I went running around the corridors frantically and luckily came across the cart, which apparently the cleaning woman had pushed out into the hall to get out of the way.
If the cart had been lost, with it would have gone seven of the astronauts who ultimately flew projects Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo.
So now we just can move on to the astronauts themselves of the Mercury program. And this is something that I've really missed out on in anything I've read about it. But there's a lovely little section from John Glenn, who was supposed to be the most kind of gung-ho and straight down the line astronaut, but here we go. I mean, it's in there somewhere.
After testing and interviewing 69 of the initial 110 prospects, Washington decides it has a sufficient pool to work with and cancels the calls of all the rest. The chosen 69 are sifted down to 32 for final testing and elimination of all but 7. The rest go back to the files. On what basis were the original 7 chosen? Frankly, but let's hear it from Dr. Bill Douglas, then an Air Force medical major, gentle, soft-spoken, and warm-hearted, who would become the family doctor to the astronauts.
We really didn't know what we were doing. We honestly didn't. There were no standards. Nobody had ever put a man in space before. If you want a pilot, we say he must have 20/20 vision to start training. Well, we didn't know whether astronauts needed 20/20 vision or even better than 20/20 vision. We knew what some of the requirements, physical, emotional, intellectual requirements were for pilots, and we went on the assumption that it would probably be the same for astronauts, so we did everything. We thought that it might serve a purpose, therefore we did it. We thought that if we didn't do it, we might find out too late that we should have done it.
What did the human subjects think of the tests? Here is one reaction from Alan Shepard, the model Annapolis graduate who will become astronaut number 1 and the first American to ride a rocket.
Actually, I think the selection program was very well conducted. The various tests, of course, were explained to us before we took them. And I think without exception, it was easy to see how they would, in fact, test an individual for the environments that were to be expected.
But as it looked to a plain-spoken Air Force captain, Deke Slayton, another of the original 7.
Well, it kind of struck me as being idiotic to a certain extent. I think it was just a matter of putting up with a bunch of crap that you didn't really believe in. But they wanted you to do it, so we did it. You know, things like putting your feet in a bucket of ice cubes and see how long you can stand it, and so you stick them in there and in dirt.
That, Dr. Bill Douglas can explain.
When you take a pilot and bring him into the laboratory and say, stick your foot in a bucket of ice water, well, he thinks you're some sort of a nut or something, and maybe you are. But it's the purpose of this cold pressor test was to examine and study the reaction of their cardiovascular system.
In the search for men who can endure being shot into space, the candidates are subjected to all kinds of torture, mental and physical. They're spun on a centrifuge till their eyeballs are squashed in. They're boiled in sweat boxes where the heat is raised to 200 degrees. They're locked alone for hours in a dark, tight room to see how they can take confinement and solitude. Most of the men calmly snooze off.
Take your pick at that will, gentlemen.
April 9th, 1959. At an historic press conference in Washington, the world meets the original 7 for the first time. The names of 7 officers of the Air Force, Navy, and Marines are called off by Dr. Glennon. Names which until this present moment have been unknown outside the circle of friends, relatives, and the services, but are now about to become world famous.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you, and I consider it a very real honor, gentlemen. From your right, Malcolm S. Carpenter, Leroy G. Cooper, John H. Glenn, Virgil I. Grissom, Walter M. Shearer, Alan B. Shepard, Donald K. Slayton. These, ladies and gentlemen, are the nation's Mercury astronauts.
Questions from the press come fast and furious. And when a woman reporter asks which test was the toughest, Glenn, a smiling Marine,
tells the lady.
That's a real tough one, and it's rather difficult to pick one because if you figure how many openings there are on the human body and how far you can go in any one of them. And...
You gave it away.
Now you answer which one would be the toughest for you.
Here in their first public appearance is the group profile of the seven new astronauts present. They stand between 5'7 and 5'10 and a half. They weigh between 150 and 180 pounds. Their ages run from 32 to 37. All come from small towns or small cities. All are married and have children. All are gifted with the special nerves, stamina, and lightning responses of seasoned test pilots. A charmed public convinces itself that each of the original seven stands at least 6 feet tall and represents a Superman. In fact, they're only average in height. And they've been chosen not because they're Supermen, but because they possess the best obtainable combination of an immense range of skills and attributes. 2 years and 21 days from now, the first of them will ride a rocket into the upper atmosphere. Until then, they will undergo a course of the most rigorous training that will transform some of the world's best test pilots into a new kind of man, the astronaut. That motor hum is the deceptively quiet voice of a ruthless monster called the centrifuge. It resembles that fun ride of the amusement parks called the whip. The victim sits in a gondola at the end of a long arm and is whirled about at increasing speeds. The effect, aside from such minor matter as dizziness and nausea, is to increase the body weight of the passenger from 1G, meaning what he weighs at normal Earth gravity, to many times over as the centrifuge speeds up. The astronauts had a mild experience with it during their testing period. Now they're really given the works. For now, the centrifuge is being used to get the answer to a vitally important question. Can a man endure the force, many, many G's, which will be brought to bear on his body by a rocket launch and by a capsule re-entry? As Deke Slayton explains...
1G, of course, is what we are sitting here on the surface of the Earth. And as you accelerate... A double acceleration over 1G is 2G, which means if you weigh 200 pounds at 1G, at 2Gs you weigh 400 pounds, at 3 you weigh 600, and so forth. And our normal launch profile on the Redstone, I believe, went up something like 11 Gs, which means if you're 200 pounds, you effectively weighed 2,200 pounds. And we went through simulated Redstone launches and re-entries, and they could program the exact G loadings and the exact timing that the booster actually did.
There was another trainer called Mastiff, designed to twist and turn through every axis at once so they could learn to bring their spacecraft back into control no matter how it tumbled, twisted, or rolled. Even today, seasoned astronauts wince at the recollection of life aboard the Mastiff. Ask Wally Schirra, Annapolis graduate from Oradell, New Jersey.
I guess it was best named Mastiff. It would sound like a bulldog tearing away at you, but the machine was designed to give us a feel for high rates. We've never felt anything like it since then. But we did achieve, I think it was 30 RPM in every one of the three axes simultaneously, which is a batch. But it was just a case of stopping roll, then pitch, then yaw, whichever. We had to stop roll first, and we all became great fans of the roll gyro at that point. It starts up just by a steady and that crescendo builds as the velocity in that particular axis builds. And the is our control, and trying to stop it with jet or jet reactions, much similar to the Mercury system.
The man who supervised this and other forms of scientific torture was again the gentle Bill Douglas. In the heroic tradition of medical pioneers,
The young flight surgeon forced himself to swallow his own bitter prescriptions, made himself go through every grueling procedure invented for the astronauts. Why? In his own words,
I wanted to know what my patients, what they were experiencing. Well, if an astronaut steps off the centrifuge and describes his experiences, all the words in the world can't really tell me what he felt, but if I had gone through the same experience on the centrifuge, I would know. He wouldn't have to tell me. They did these things many, many times. I did them once or twice. I learned very, very early, don't compete with them. Participate, but don't compete, because you're lost to start with if you try to compete with people of that caliber.
We will learn 10 years later, when the Soviet Union permits NBC to make a television documentary, that the entire cosmonaut testing and training program has been strikingly similar to our own, even to machines like the centrifuge and the Mastiff.
Sounds like pretty fearful stuff to have to go through. Not for me, I'm afraid. So let's get into space. And Alan Shepard, of course, was the first American to go up into space in a suborbital mission. And I think John Glenn was the first to orbit the Earth. And there's just some weird stuff that went on his flight. And he nearly ran out of fuel maneuvering around and almost got stuck there forever, because he was fascinated by what he was seeing. And in his own words, here it is.
This is Friendship 7. I'll try to describe what I'm in here. I am in a big mass of some very small particles that are brilliantly lit up like they're luminescent. I never saw anything like it. They're around the little, they're coming by the capsule. And they look like little stars, a whole shower of them coming by.
So the Gemini missions followed the Mercury missions, and I'm going to skip by them because we're going to run out of time otherwise. So what made the Apollo missions possible was the sheer size of the Saturn V rocket. There's a lot of machinery to actually lift into orbit, with a command module, the LEM and the capsule, plus all the fuel. I mean, this is a test launch, I think, of one of the Saturn, the first test launch of the Saturn V, and a little bit of info about it afterwards. There's a nice little bit from Walter Cronkite, who sort of loses his cool somewhat.
November 9th, 1967. 7 years from the date that North American Aviation received the contract, and 40 weeks after the disaster, we make the first full unmanned test of Saturn V, the three-stage Goliath that is eventually to pitch the Apollo spacecraft to the moon.
Gene C, how are you?
It's a good flight.
ECAM, good flight. Booster good?
Go at this time.
Go all the way, booster.
As the sound waves reach the press site, 3.1 miles from the pad.
They're in shape.
That was Walter Cronkite, usually a calm observer of world crises, as the commotion of Saturn V's blastoff threatens to shake apart the booth where Cronkite is reporting the launch for CBS. The Apollo Saturn V assembly, tall as a 36-story building, weighing over 6 million pounds, outstrips the wildest fantasies of man. 19 times more powerful than Atlas, it takes off with a thrust equivalent to 160 million horsepower from five engines clustered at its base like the number 5 on dice. The roar of its liftoff makes the noise of 25,000 stereo sets playing full blast. It vibrates the innards of anybody standing within 3.5 miles of the launch site. In terms of weightlifting, it's as though we had picked a Navy destroyer out of the water and thrown it to the moon. Everything about this newest bird involves superlatives. It stretches the vocabulary of all who attempt to describe it. It's so huge, so complicated, that the Kennedy Space Center had to create a whole new way of handling and carrying it. All sections are stacked on top of each other in a barn 52 stories high costing $108,700,000. This is the world's largest building, with an interior space so vast that it creates its own weather. If it were not for 10,000 tons of air conditioning, clouds would form inside and it would rain. On August 26th, the whole assembly rolled out through garage doors that are 45 stories high on a vast tractor called the crawler, which is as big as a baseball diamond, and whose tread assembly, with each shoe weighing a ton, stands almost twice the height of a man. All this moved almost imperceptibly at a third of a mile an hour to pad A at the moonport over a special 3.5 mile long road. Altogether, in its every dimension, Saturn V reduces man to a dwarf, except in the one most important dimension. It is man who has conceived, designed, and built all this ingenious immensity.
So I'm going to move on now to some of the Apollo missions. Now, this is going to be about Apollo 9, which didn't go to the moon at all, but tested out some of the equipment in just the most incredible, under the most incredible conditions. I mean, it just beggars belief, really. There's a little bit of narration in this talking about the lunar module itself, but some of the actual live transmissions of, this was the first mission where they tested out separating the lunar module and the command module and then seeing if they would be able to dock them back together again. If they couldn't, that was it, game over. I mean, it just staggers me. So this is a longish excerpt with various bits and pieces of live transmission.
The flight commander is Air Force Colonel Jim McDivitt, who won his space wings with Gemini 4 when Ed White took America's first walk in space. Jim is always mindful of the tragic death of White, along with Grissom and Chaffee, but says...
Really, these men lost their lives in the conquest of space, not just a little piece of it, but all of it. And I think that was what I had expected when I came into the program.
Jim's second in command is Air Force Colonel Dave Scott, who has survived not only 3 jet plane mishaps, but also the terrible tumble in space of Gemini 8 3 years ago. Third man is a red-haired civilian, Russell Rusty Schweiker, farm boy from New Jersey and a former Air Force pilot. He reads philosophy for fun, loves far-out classical music, and prefers gourmet food to the steak diet favored by other astronauts. When Rusty tests the new lunar module, how can he be sure it's going to work?
It's like getting out of your bedroom in the morning and going out to the garage, and there's your car sitting there. You don't know if it's going to work when you turn on the key or not. And I might add that we have the same confidence in our LEM that you have, in all likelihood, in your car.
Though newest man of the crew, Rusty is charged with one of its most hazardous experiments, our first untethered spacewalk. He will rely completely on a backpack called the Portable Life Support System. The main purpose of Apollo 9 is to test the 2 pieces of hardware vital for a moon landing: a portable life support system, and also a bizarre man-made insect called the Lunar Module, or LEM. One day, in this 15-ton taxi, 2 astronauts will leave the Apollo command module in lunar orbit and descend to the moon. This is the strangest vehicle ever created on Earth, for it can't actually travel on Earth. It's the first pure spacecraft, intended to perform either in weightlessness or on the moon area, where gravity is 1/6 that of Earth. This creature has 4 spindly legs to stand on. Above them, a hatch gapes like an open mouth. 2 triangular windows glare like evil eyes. The top is garnished by antennas, like flowers on a crazy hat. The walls of the seatless cabin are made of aluminum about as thick as a frying pan. Other areas are covered with heavy aluminum foil that could be kicked in by an astronaut's boot. Fragility is the price paid to make the LEM as light as possible. The main weight must go into a fuel supply weighing 3 times the vehicle itself and 2 separate rocket engines for descent and ascent. The descent engine is housed in the LEM's lower half. Its throttle gives the LEM the ability to hover so that the astronauts in a moon landing
can look out a window and be sure the touchdown site is suitable. Once the LEM is landed, this lower section will be used as the launch pad and blasting off from the moon by means of the ascent engine, which is housed in the upper section. The whole thing has been compared to a badly wrapped Christmas package. Price per copy, $41 million. Code name for this one, Spider. Now, on Monday morning, March 3rd, 1969...
Liftoff. We have liftoff at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
McDivitt's and Scott's hearts are found to be ticking at twice their normal rates. But Rusty's at only a few beats more. 7 minutes later, he cheerfully calls back to Earth.
And the rookie says that looks beautiful.
In Earth orbit, some 3 hours later, Dave Scott, now in the left couch, separates the command service module from the third stage of the rocket and does a U-turn. It brings the spacecraft back to a position where it is nose-to-nose with Spider, which is lurking behind open panels inside the front end of the third stage. Delicately, Dave maneuvers the docking with Spider and reports...
Apollo 9, understand, hard dock. Good show.
Reported hard dock at 302.08.
Later, he flips a switch that releases the two nose-coupled craft from the third stage, the S-4B. Alone now, the linked ships are whipped, shaken, rattled, and rolled in orbit to prove them a solid combination. Spider remains securely fastened to Gumdrop, as the command module is nicknamed. On the second day, Rusty first, then Jim, float through the connecting tunnel and take their stand-up places in the seatless moon taxi. Next day, Rusty climbs out on the front porch of Spider and spends 40 minutes testing his backpack and taking pictures.
Okay, Dave, come on out.
Okay. Come on, let the camera run here.
Dave, come on out wherever you are.
Stand by, let me put away my little push button. Yeah, we're all taking pictures of everybody taking pictures.
Yeah, you want to retrieve a sample?
This is Houston. You are go for undocking.
Now on the fourth day comes the crucial test. Spider prepares to cast off from Gumdrop to continue in Earth orbit all on its own. If it fails to manage independent flight, if it should prove unable to return for a recoupling with Apollo 9, it means death for McDivitt and Schweiker. The LEM, being without a heat shield, cannot return to Earth. Now, Dave Scott trips the switch to release the 12 latches holding the two ships together at the tunnel, and radios the men in Spider.
Okay, you're free.
I'm free?
Roger. What did you do? Oh, went back to the old memory and did a cycle on the switch, and you look like you're free.
For nearly 2 hours, Spider romps in its new orbit above Gumdrop. The new orbit is wider than Gumdrop's, therefore covering more distance. As a result, Spider falls steadily behind until it is trailing Gumdrop by more than 113 miles.
DIPS is armed, the descent propulsion system is armed, and control says he's at the low throttle point.
Now, in order to rendezvous and redock with Gumdrop, Spider fires its descent engine, which brings it down into a circular orbit. Then explosive bolts are fired off to dump the bottom half of the LEM. In turn, the ascent engine is fired, thrusting Spider below Gumdrop into a smaller orbit. From 50 miles away, Jim and Rusty aim Spider for its final approach to the docking with Gumdrop. Then, at the 3 mile mark, Dave spots Jim and Rusty.
Oh, I see him. Not there. Somewhere in the sunlight.
Great.
And 31 minutes later, the friendliest, funniest Spider fires its thrusters for the closing maneuvers. But glaring sunlight blinds Jim and Rusty.
I just can't even see the coax, Dave. I don't know exactly where you are with respect to it.
Okay, you want me to do it?
So let me work my way in here a little closer.
Okay. Dave, I just can't see it. Let me get in a little closer. Are you coming fine? Just keep coming easy like that. Looks like you're coming from an angle, but you're coming in with the right attitude. It's going to go forward to your right a little bit, relative to your body. Doing fine. Right there. Oh, that doesn't look like it's for me. I just can't see the darn collapse. I can't tell what my attitude is. Keep it coming. You're almost there. Okay, you're about there. I have capture.
Good, good.
Okay. They're lined up. Okay, why don't you do it? I can't tell where it is. We're free now.
That was a very nice docking. That wasn't a docking. That was an eye test.
Okay, Houston, we're locked up.
It just staggers me, the unflappability of these pilots, astronauts. I mean, it just absolutely staggers me. So we moved from Apollo 9 to Apollo 8, which was the first mission to actually go to the moon. They orbited the moon, tested systems. They were the first people to see the Earth from so far away and to see the Earth rise. And there are so many moments on this mission which are just astonishing. And I can't play you everything. But I want to relate it to this last clip and play you the bit where they have to fire the engines when they're on the other side of the moon. So they're out of communication with mission control. Everybody back on the Earth just has to sit and wait.
Apollo 8, Houston.
They emerge at the right
time.
We
have 3 minutes.
Which will signify that it's gone
right. All systems are go.
Back.
Apollo 8, Apollo 8, this is Houston. 3 minutes, LOS. All systems are go. Over.
And at 88 hours, 51 minutes, we show loss of signal with the spacecraft. Our next communications with Apollo 8 should come in about 37 minutes. We are now about 28 minutes prior to our trans-Earth injection maneuver. We are now less than 30 seconds to the scheduled time of ignition for the maneuver to start Apollo 8 on its course back to Earth. And here in Mission Control Center, we've just counted down to the burn. We should have ignition at this time. And here in Mission Control, it is relatively quiet, as it has been since we lost communications with the spacecraft as they went over the moon's horizon. At this point, flight controllers here in Mission Control, as with the rest of the world, they are waiting. This is Apollo Control, Houston. We now show less than 30 seconds until reacquisition. We'll stand by for the first words from the Apollo 8 crew as they come over the lunar horizon. We have RF signal, and we should be hearing from the crew shortly.
Apollo 8, Houston. Apollo 8, Houston. Apollo 8, Houston.
Apollo 8, over.
Hello, Apollo 8. Loud and clear.
Roger. Please be informed there is a Santa Claus.
That's affirmative. You're the best one to know.
Morning, Apollo 8. Deke here. I'd just like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas on behalf of everyone in the control center and I'm sure everyone around the world. None of us ever expect to have a better Christmas present than this one. Hope you get a good night's sleep from here on and enjoy your Christmas dinner tomorrow and look forward to seeing you in Hawaii on the 28th.
Okay, leader, we'll see you there. That was a very, very nice ride that lasted. This engine is as smooth as glass.
Yeah, we gathered that. An outstanding job all the way around.
Thank everybody on the ground for us. Yeah, it's pretty clear we wouldn't be anywhere if we didn't have them helping us out here.
And so we move on to the most famous mission of them all, Apollo 11. You will recognize an awful lot of the recording in this next next piece, because it's just become, so many of the phrases have become a part of our sonic landscape. Unavoidable. They've been in rave tunes. The Orb put them in a lot of tunes in music. You'll just hear them in bulletins or rock and roll years, documentaries, all sorts of stuff. It's just a part of the culture. But I'm going to play a longish excerpt, so hopefully there'll be some bits that you haven't really heard. This is Neil Armstrong landing the Eagle.
Down, down, down to the pockmarked lunar face.
We're go, same type, we're go. 2,000 feet, 2,000 feet,
into the egg, 47 degrees, roger, 47 degrees. Eagle
looking great, you're go. Altitude 1,600, 1,400 feet, still looking very good. Computers do the thinking, yes, but sometimes they go wrong. Aboard the Eagle, a guidance computer issues alarms. They have only a little fuel to spend. From 240,000 miles away, Houston says the computer is overstrained. It's program alarm, 1202.
Roger, 1202, we copy it. 35 degrees, 750, coming down to 23. 700 feet, 21 down, 33 degrees.
The decision is up to Neil Armstrong. Eagle now descends toward a yawning crater filled with menacing boulders.
100 feet down to 19. 540 feet down to 30, down to 15. 400 feet down at 9. Escape forward. 150 feet down at 4. 30, 3.5 down. 3.5, 47 forward. Put up. On 1.5 down. 70. 8. Epic shadow out there. 50 down at 2.5. 19 forward. Altitude velocity light. 3.5 down. 220 feet. 13 forward. 11 forward, coming down nicely. 200 feet. 4.5 down. 5.5 down. Within 60 feet. 6.5 down. 5.5 down. 9 forward. Good. 120 feet. 100 feet. 3.5 down. 9 forward. 5%. 75. 75 feet. That's looking good. Down a half. 6 forward. 60 seconds.
Armstrong has made his decision. He is landing the module manually as Aldrin reads off the facts and figures. It takes a little longer than planned, but...
Lights on. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. That's 40 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Break shadow. 4 forward. 4 forward. Drift into the right a little. 1.5.
30 seconds.
Forward. Just. That's. Okay. Backlight. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent.
Auto descent.
Control both auto descent. Engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. This is Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams, and it's pretty much the end. So if you want to get in touch with suggestions or complaints or whatever you like. You can email us at voiceonrecord@gmail.com. voiceonrecord@gmail.com. This program has been about space exploration, and who better to leave you with again than Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin speaking to you from the surface of the moon in July 1969.
Houston, that may have seemed like a very long final phase. The auto targeting was taking us right into a football field sized crater with a large number of big boulders and rocks for about a 1 or 2 crater diameters around it. And it required us going in P-66 and flying manually over the rock field to find a reasonably good area.
Sounds good to us, Tranquility. Be advised, there are lots of smiling faces in this room and all over the world. Over.
All right, 2 of them up here.
Roger, it was a beautiful job, you guys.
And don't forget one in the command module.
Roger.
Now, we'll get to the details of what's around here, but it looks like a collection of just about every variety of shape, angularity, granularity, but every variety of rock you could find. The color is, it varies pretty much depending on how you're looking relative to the real phase point. There doesn't appear to be too much of a general color at all. However, it looks as though some of the rocks and boulders, of which there are quite a few in the near area, looks as though they're going to have some interesting colors to them. Over.
Roger, copy.
Houston, this is Tranquility. We're standing by for a go for cabin depress. Over.
Tranquility Base, this is Houston. You are go for cabin depressurization. Go for cabin depressurization.
The hatch is coming open.
Okay, Houston, I'm on the porch.
Roger, Neil. And we're getting a picture on the TV. Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. As the surface is fine and powdery, I can kick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and inside of my boot. I only go in a fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine sandy particles. It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of the United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Now I want to back up and partially close that. Making sure not to lock it on my way out. Okay, I'm on the top step, and I can look down over the RCU and find the gear pad. It's a very simple matter to hop down from one step to the next.
Yes, I found it to be very comfortable, and walking is also very comfortable.
There's a slight tendency I can see now to backwards due to the soft, very soft texture.
Are you standing on a rock, big rock there now?
I say that the rocks are rather slippery. You have to be careful that you're leaning in the direction you want to go, otherwise you watch at the edge of that crater is
that's soft. So soft there, isn't it?
Hey, Neil, didn't I say we might see some purple rocks?
Find a purple rock?
Yep. Neil is now unveiling the plaque.
It says, "Dear men from the planet Earth, first set foot upon the moon, July 1969, AP."
It came in peace with all mankind. It has the crew members' signatures and the signature of the President of the United States.